You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, and solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, except it's not sunny today.
No,
it's a cold day. It's the first day of winter, which isn't supposed to happen for another 3 weeks, but hey, here we are. No, it's December 21st is supposed to be the first day of winter. Another month and a half. Eek. But we know in Iowa, winter doesn't really start in December. It starts whenever it starts.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And welcome, everyone. And don't forget, if you can't listen to the whole show today, or you want to recommend it to someone, this is rebroadcast
Monday morning, 8 a.m. Mm-hmm. Writers' Voices is broadcast usually live every week. We're live probably 45 weeks out of the year on Fridays at 1 p.m. and rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. on KRUU-FM 100.1 in Fairfield or KRUUFM.com. And also check out past shows in writersvoices.com. And in fact, you can listen to our previous interview with today's guest at writersvoices.com.
Okay.
And who is our guest today?
Kate Hamer. Did I get that right?
Yep.
Okay. Is the author of The Girl in the Red Coat, which was very famous. And that particular novel was a Costa First Novel Award finalist, a Dagger Award finalist, an Amazon Best Book of the Year for 2016, and a winner of the Elle Lettres Reader's Prize. And right now she lives in Cardiff, Wales, with her husband and two children. And what's it like in Cardiff, Wales?
How's the weather in Wales today?
Today, we've had a beautiful day here, actually.
Good.
Great. So Kate's new book is called The Doll Funeral. And it's a little bit different, isn't it?
You might say that
it's a little bit different than The Girl in the Red Coat, which is a good thing.
Mm. Yeah,
you don't want to do the same thing twice, right, Kate?
No, I think there's are the same, and I think there are things that are different.
That is true.
Yeah, it's a coming of age book again.
Well, welcome back to Writers' Voices.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Now, when we spoke before, you told us about you'd had a career in documentary filmmaking, but you'd always been writing just for yourself all along the way.
Yes, that's right.
And then at some point, you decided to give this novel writing thing your full attention, and you went and tell us the story of how The Girl in the Red Coat came to be and how your life has changed.
Stories and ideas for books and novels, and I've been writing, I can't remember from when, you know, from being a really young child, really. I think I entered and won a short story competition called the Rhys Davies Prize here, and I think that gave me a lot of confidence to continue with it, because I think you need... As a writer, you do need some kind of validation that what you're doing is, you know, that it's got some merit to it, I suppose. So that was a big turning point for me. It came around the same time that my children left home. And I just thought, I've always wanted to embark on this incredible journey of writing a novel. And so I did. I've seized the day, I suppose, is what they say, and began The Girl in the Red Coat. No conception that it would even be published, let alone anything else would happen to it. So it was just really having faith in the whole dream, I think.
And from the outside looking in, it may appear that for you the dream came true pretty easily. Does it feel that way to you?
It was I. Ba- both, really. I think I've been lucky. I do. I've had a lot of good people that have, you know, supported the book and who've helped me. But on the other hand, I think the more I talk to everybody that's been published, the route to publication is always very circuitous and takes lots of twists and turns, and mine certainly has as well. And I think it was really just sticking with the faith of wanting to write a story that absolutely burned passionately within me that kept me going. And so I wouldn't say it was easy. It was there were a lot of twists and turns on the route to it, but I think that's very common for writers. And I think unless you feel very compelled to write your story, you know, you won't, because it's a lot of hard work. You won't stick with it. But I think I wouldn't want to put anybody off, because I think if you've got a book to write that's burning within you, you should do it. And wherever that journey is going to take you, in whatever form, you know, the writing of it is as important as anything.
That is very true, and that's part of why we have this show.
Right.
Writers' Voices, and to hear from people who've been through it, to help encourage those who are maybe at the beginning of the process now.
Yeah. And I think you know, I write to have readers. Of course, you want to connect with people and to have readers. But I think in the first instance, I know Stephen King. I don't know if anybody's read his book. Listening, it's called On Writing.
Oh, yes,
absolutely, probably the best thing I've ever read about writing. And I feel that he just tells it as it is. And he talks about writing. He talks about writing being in two phases, writing with the door closed and writing with the door open. So the first phase, which is very much how I wrote both the novels, is you totally immerse yourself in that world, and you write as if nobody is ever going to read it. It's your own world that you're curating and creating. Because if you start thinking about somebody looking over your shoulder and reading it, I think it could freeze you, and you might never write another word, because, you know, the idea of having that kind of level of scrutiny would be awful at that stage. So, but when you've written your first draft, I think then is the time to let the world in and think about, you know, your first reader, whoever that is, and about starting to look at it with a more critical eye. But people that are writing, and I'm sure they already have, but if they haven't, I would thoroughly recommend the Stephen King book. I'm looking at it on my shelf now. It's very well thumbed.
Yes, it's. I'm pretty sure I have that one on my shelf at home too. But it's been a while since I've read it, and now I'm inspired to go back and take another look at it. Mm-hmm. But I do remember it being meaningful, and yeah. So, Kate, when when The Girl in the Red Coat came out, it attracted a lot of attention. How did that affect your ability to move on and write the next book?
Well, at the beginning, I think it was quite a scary prospect because of the attention that the first book did have. You know, it's with your debut novel, when you're writing, nobody knows what you're doing. Nobody is, you know, like I said, I didn't even know it was going to be published. So there is a certain freedom in that, I suppose. So when it comes to the second novel, it is a different kind of proposition. And so I, at the beginning, maybe for a week or two, there was a slight nervousness about it. But I think I made the same decision that I did with the first one, and at some point I just decided to write the book that was burning inside me. And once I'd made that decision, it actually was fine, and it kind of very much flowed from there. Once I'd found the location as well, which was another story.
Okay. Sounds like we need to hear that story.
I think we do. Yes, yes, we do.
Yeah, I tried to write it several times in different locations, and it was very strange. There was just something always off kilter, and never felt quite right. It's quite a spooky tale, and it needed somewhere suitably spooky. So I tried to write it in various locations in the UK, and on a day out, just not very far from us, and I don't know why, I had never been there before, but I saw a sign for a little place called the Forest of Dean, which I don't know if any of your listeners have ever heard of, but it's on the borders between Wales and England. We went in, we followed the signs and went in, and I just found it extraordinary. And again, I don't know how usual it is, but here it's very, very unusual to have a community that lives in a forest environment. And that's what it is. It's a very, very ancient forest environment where there are still 21st centuries living and working. It goes back to, there's mining that goes back to the Iron Age. Mm-hmm. It was a royal hunting ground in medieval times with deer hunting. And it's just incredibly atmospheric place. And that's during the day. I would dread to think what it feels like if it's there at night.
Well, your characters know, don't they?
Well, they know. Yeah, they do know. But it just absolutely connected with the story. And I must admit it, I just cried because I knew my story had found its location. It was in search of place before that, and it found its place. Very much so, and it connected with so many things. I mean, I was brought up on North European fairy tales, and forests feature in so many of them. They're places of threat or exploration or liberation, and it's all of those in the book. So And just basically, just full of atmosphere, you know, and that's what I love in a book. I love a strong atmosphere. That's what I look for. I look to be transported into a different world and a different feeling, you know. I had to choose one of my favorite books recently, and I chose Rebecca, the Daphne du Maurier book, and I think that's got such an incredible sense of atmosphere to it.
Were you being asked to write an essay for one of those collections of favorite books?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, yes. I wrote it about atmosphere. It was an interesting exercise, actually.
Yeah, we've
realized how much that's what I read for. I read for that feeling of I don't know.
I love reading those essay collections. I've got we've had some on the show before. I think there was one 100 books that changed my life or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then we've got one coming up later in November. The World Is Just a Book Away. Are you familiar with that one?
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. That one is interesting because the man who started putting together that collection got distracted midway by realizing how important these books were, and he had connected with some pretty influential people, and they started building libraries in places where kids don't have access to libraries, and they've now built 80 libraries before he managed to finish the book that started it all.
Right. Wow. Libraries were so important to me growing up. I grew up in a very rural community, and it's not there anymore, unfortunately. But there was a very small but very well-stocked public library there that I use constantly. And I think they're an absolute lifeline for people. I really, really do. And it's in the way that theatre is not accessible to lots and lots of people. There are lots of art forms that are not accessible to people. But I was so lucky, I think, to have access to albeit very small and rural library. You know, and I don't know how you affix there, but here they've been very diminished.
Well, here in our little town, it's a town of about 10,000, and the library's still going strong. Mm-hmm. It was originally a Carnegie library, funded by Andrew Carnegie, who was a American philanthropist. He was, I think, a railroad guy. And he built libraries all across the country. The one here in Fairfield was the first one.
I think there's not very far from me, actually, in Cardiff, in Canton. I think there's a Carnegie library there as well.
Oh, wow. And this was the first one built west of the Mississippi River. Mm. Here in our little town. And, Mom, I don't know if I ever told you this, but when our family moved here in Fairfield, I was in ninth grade, and we were moving from Pennsylvania, which is about 1,000 miles away, and it's a hard time for kids to move. And before we came, my dad had come out and bought a house, and he'd brought back the telephone book, and the telephone book back then had a map of the town in it, and I just pored over that map because I saw where the house was, and it was 2 blocks from the library. And to me, that was like the most exciting thing in the world. That I was going to live 2 blocks from a library.
And Anne and Joel went up to the library the first day.
Hard to sort of decide how. I think these days, I'm just looking at my bookshelves and you know, the books that I've kept and keep on my shelf. Do you read on Kindle as well? Have you gone that way?
Yes, or? I do. I do.
You do?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I haven't quite made the leap to Kindle.
I do both, and there are times when I definitely prefer the physical book, but when I'm traveling, obviously the Kindle, because I can have as many books as I want and not have to lug them around.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kate Hamer, author of The Doll Funeral.
Which is very appropriate for this time of year. Halloween.
This
is
a good Halloween novel, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Now, The Girl in the Red Coat was spooky in its way, but it wasn't supernatural, whereas this one you brought in the element of supernatural. What led you to do that? Was there something that inspired that for you, other than Stephen King?
I think The Girl in the Red Coat, there is a very slight supernatural feel to it.
More than
anything else. Yeah. It's something that interests me. I wanted to write a book, I think, with The Doll Funeral, that is as much, it's about family. It's about the idea of the past and whether we can ever free ourselves from the past and create our own futures and also maybe kind of choose our own destinies and choose our own families. So Ruby, my hero in the book, that's just what she does. So the supernatural is a very good kind of way of doing that, because she's haunted literally and figuratively by her past, and she has to make the decision whether she goes forward and tries to break free from that. So it's a real thing in the book. There are unquiet spirits that walk, but it also poses the question that are we always dictated to by what's gone before? Can we choose new futures for ourselves? I had something I was really fascinated by, which was the idea that, I knew my grandparents. I was very close to my grandmother. I didn't know her parents. I knew their names. But beyond that, I have no idea what they were called, who they were, what they did. And beyond that again, 3-4 generations back, I really don't know. And I just found, I had the idea of how much still those people that I have no conception of who they were or what they were called are possibly still influencing me and my children, whether it's through ideas, whether it was the way they brought my great-grandparents up, which has come down the generations, whether it's gestures or whether it's genes or even a turn of phrase or something like that. So the sense of the past really permeates this new book, and there's because it's in a forest environment as well. One of the characters says, "Who knows what's out there, being buried year on year by another layer of leaves?" And my hero Ruby finds out on her 13th birthday that she is adopted, and she decides to go in the quest of her real parents. And because of that, she starts uncovering all this stuff, all this buried stuff from the past and all these secrets.
And it's not always pleasant what she finds.
No, but I think journeys like that are always going to be slightly dangerous. And, when you start rooting around like that, one never knows what they're going to find, I think, and that's very true of her. She finds out on her 13th birthday, as I said, that she's adopted, so she has had a pretty dreadful life up until that point, so her reaction to this is sort of quite unexpected, in the sense that she feels it's like a new beginning, a new hope in a way, that there might be a different future for her. But fantasies of what that might be are always going to be at fantasies, so who knows what you can start uncovering once you start digging around in family history, as she does.
My mother's chuckling. She may be remembering one of my brothers who at some point was sure he was adopted.
Yeah.
and probably had some fantasies about what his, who his real parents were.
I think it's quite a common fantasy, actually. Particularly, you never know. You think it might be a princess, I suppose, and all sorts of things.
Yep.
I assure him he was not adopted.
Right, because Mom already had two children under 3 at the time he was born. No one in their right mind would adopt a baby with two kids under 3 in the house.
Oh, my goodness. No, you wouldn't.
Well, Kate, how would you like to read from the novel so we can get an idea of
sure.
particularly the atmosphere of the story?
Should I read? Maybe I'll read several small passages. Maybe I'll start off reading the very first chapter, which is the piece that I've been mentioning, and where the book kind of really, it was the catalyst, this image that I'm about to read. I had a very strong impression, filmic sort of impression of it. It's just about a page and a half, so I'll
okay.
read this now.
Great.
I knew the moment that Mum called me, something was going to happen. I heard it in her voice. Ruby, the open eye of the hall mirror watched as I came downstairs humming a nervous tune, my yoke yellow birthday blouse done right up to the neck and my brown cord skirt flicking against a knee scab. The light from the open kitchen doorway where my parents waited puddled onto the dirty carpet in the hall. On the formica table was the birthday cake. It had white icing, Smarties and 13 candles. A big triangle wedge had been cut out and the sharp carving knife lay close by, pointing into the gap. I blinked. I'd expected punishment for some minor crime committed, a cup broken or left unwashed, the back door left open or closed or whichever way my father didn't want it that day. But instead, it seemed my mum and dad had turned into dolls or puppets. Hard lines had appeared, running from their noses to their chins. Mum's cheeks were blotched with anxious red paint, corkscrew curls exploding from her head. Dad was strung stiffly behind her in his grey felt jacket. His arm came up and swiped at his nose. Mum jiggled, her shoes clacking menacingly on the lino. Her jaw opened. Ruby, now we don't want you to create a scene or start trouble, but it's time you knew. From behind her, Dad said, in that furred-up voice of someone who's kept quiet for a bit, yes, 13 is old enough. On the cake between us, the Smarties had started to leak sharp colours, as if they were flies that had got trapped there and were now slowly bleeding to death. Ruby, there's something we've been keeping from you all these years, Mum said. She paused, then spoke in a rush. It's that you're not our natural child. We didn't give birth to you. Which explains a lot. Stop it, just for this once, Mick. Leave the girl alone. She turned to me. Ruby, you were adopted when you were 4 months old. You are not our child. Do you hear me? She turned. Honestly, Mick, I don't think she's taking it in. But I was. I ran into the garden and sang for joy.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the opening.
Yes, and you mentioned that Ruby's life was pretty miserable. And I think even in that very first early scene, you can see that her relationship with her parents was not a good one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So you said that this scene was sort of the inspiration. Do you remember like when it came to you, how it came to you?
I think similar to the girl in the red coat, I think it just seems to be the way that I work, that there's a very strong central image that starts everything off. For the first book, it was just that kind of idea of a young girl standing in a forest alone. She's wearing a red duffel coat, and she's lost, and the forest dark behind her. And it was the kind of mission in that book to find out what had happened and why she's lost and why she's missing. And the same here, it was... this opening scene was just an image that sort of plagued me, I suppose. It was of, again, a young girl, maybe slightly older. She's 13 as the book opens. And she's running through a sort of unkempt house. And it's as if a camera is following her behind. Her hair's flowing out behind her, and she's running towards an open back door and into an overgrown garden where she stands, looks up at the sky, and starts singing. And where these images come from, I really don't know. I think there are probably lots of bits of various different things that all come together. But I just find that when one gets hold of me, it's very hard to let to. I was going to say, it's very hard to let go of it. I think it's the other way around. It doesn't let go of me. Until I've really explored that story, and this was Ruby's story.
Wow. Now, did you know from the beginning how sort of dark the story would be?
I don't know. I tend to write as where the where the story takes me. I don't kind of think, is this going to be funny? Is it going to be dark? I mean, I think it's got lots of redemptive things in it as well. But I, as a reader, again, I'm looking at my bookshelves as I'm talking to you here. I tend to read. That is what I enjoy reading. My Twitter handle says I'm really a pretty happy person. I write dark. I just do. It comes naturally to me, and it's what, again, going back to Stephen King, he always says, write what you like to read, otherwise it's not going to feel right. Mm. And that's what I like to read. I read art I'm looking at now on my shelves. I read Gillian Flynn, Helen Dunmore, Dickens. Dickens was a pretty dark writer, I think. Philip Pullman. And but I don't like unrelenting misery or darkness. I like the fact, and I think to me that reflects life, that there's all shades twisted around in a kind of plait, you know, in a kind of braid, I think you call it there. So there's a little bit of everything. There's a strand of light and a strand of grey and a strand of dark. And I think that's true of life, really. So I'm just hoping to reflect that, I think.
Now, definitely in The Doll Funeral, adults are not very reliable.
No.
No,
they're not. And actually, Ruby's story is based on somebody I know very well, and who had a very similar childhood to Ruby's, and who I had long conversations with. I mean, all the details have been changed, all the factual stuff, but the kind of emotional resonance, I hope, is very authentic there for anybody that's reading it. And no, adults are not reliable at all. She, again, it's that theme of forging your own identity, and she decides very early on that's what she's going to do, and she's going to make her own mind up about things. I very much wanted to write a character who was despite everything, who was brave and feisty and often had setbacks, but you know, it didn't completely rule out her taking the path to sort of discovering herself and her own strength.
Kate, I'm curious how your children react to the things that you write.
Well, they're both grown up now, and I think they're slightly bemused. They're proud at the same time. I think they're a bit like, oh, what's Mum gone and done now? but no, I think they're pretty proud, you know. But I think there's always going to be and that's another thing with writing. I would say to people is that, you know, you've got to do your own thing. You can't worry too much, you know, and just do it, because your family will be pleased with you and be proud, you know.
So they're not like, I never knew you had this in you, Mother.
I think they always suspected.
Oh, yeah.
Well, certainly the I'm sure they suspected the part about you being a successful writer, but about, you know, the darkness and the kind of the horror aspect of it. Or did they suspect that too?
It's true, and I really do feel that, as you know, and writing now my third novel, it's that writing, the thing about writing with the door closed. And I think, you know, I try and write, particularly the first draft, as if nobody's looking, because that's the only way you can do it. Otherwise, you get so worried that about what people might think or what they would say about it. The only solution that I can think of is that you do it as if nobody is looking and nobody's ever going to read, you know. Which, of course, is what you really want, is readers. So it's a bit of a dualistic thing that you're doing with yourself when you're writing.
Well, a lot of children have imaginary friends. I had I had two imaginary friends, and I.
Do you remember their names?
Yes, Polly and Donus.
What were they called?
Polly and Donus.
A girl and a boy.
I don't remember that.
Well, Polly must have been a girl.
Girl, yeah.
But what was Donus?
I don't know.
Don't.
Donus.
I don't know.
A name, or is that the? Is that a made-up name? Or?
Oh, yeah, it's a made-up name.
A made-up name.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I ever knew anybody named Donus, but I played alone a lot when I was a kid. I had a lot of dolls, and I played dolls. And
yeah, I think there's a lot of benefits to that, actually. I mean, I know children now, and, you know, possibly my children were sort of very, very... We're very worried about entertaining them and having activities for every 5 minutes of the day.
Yeah, and, right.
And clubs and, you know, learning things and, you know, all this sort of thing. But actually, in some ways, the times that I remember when I was a child are those times just completely swept up in either reading or... alone and in my imagination and being in the garden and being with nature and things like that. And I do think there's a huge amount of benefit to all that maybe we've lost a little bit with our digital age, even though I wouldn't want to sort of totally say how everything's dreadful now and everything was wonderful in the past. But I do wonder whether, you know, that those sort of those kind of lonely or alone times as a child are actually really good for us in some ways, and a lot comes of them.
I agree. And you mentioned, you know, getting out in nature, being in the garden, and children in a lot of communities in America, and I don't know if it's the same in the UK, don't go outside and play by themselves anymore because their parents are afraid of them being snatched. Mm. Even though I'm not sure it happens really any more now than it did then, but there's more awareness of it and more fear of it. And of course, that's kind of what the girl in the red coat was about.
Yeah, I know. I know. I don't quite know how to answer that one because it's a dualistic thing, because I do think it's great for kids to be out there and to be grubbing around in the earth and the you know, making dens and doing all that sort of thing, and it's actually. No, I think I grew up in a village as well, in a very small community, in a rural community. So maybe there was more scope for it in that sort of environment, because it was really important to me. And I think my books tend to be kind of books about rural life and rural upbringings as well. They're not big city environments, the locations of the books. Maybe in the future, maybe one day. But it is these small towns, small villages, and rural communities that kind of thread through them.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kate Hamer, author of The Doll Funeral, and also The Girl in the Red Coat. We talked earlier, Kate, about, you know, the publishing process and how circuitous it can be. Was it a lot easier for the second book?
Well, it was easier because I don't know how it's done in the States, but here certainly it was bought. The Girl in the Red Coat was bought at the same time as they call it a two book deal. Mm. So you've written the first one, and they're wanting the second one as soon as the first one's been published. So in terms of publication, it wasn't totally different at all. It's the same publisher. It's Faber and Faber, who have been great. And I'm writing my third one now, and again, it'll be a Faber and Faber book. But like I said earlier, I think everybody's route to publication is very, very different. And there are lots of twists and turns in the journey before you get there, unless you're very lucky, which is quite unusual, I think, where it's all very, very straightforward.
And in the U.S., it's published by Melville House.
That's right,
right,
yeah.
Yeah, and it looks like it was the Faber and Faber in the U.K. came out last February.
That's right, right. Yeah.
And the U.S. Version came out in August, which is pretty quick.
Uh-huh.
Pretty quick. Have you been published in other countries as well?
Yes, absolutely. There's all over the place. Italy and France and Croatia and China and lots and lots. I've just come back in September. We were over in Russia because they've published both books there. And we did a tour of Russia. We went to St. Petersburg and Moscow because it's doing very well there as well. So, yeah, and lots and lots of... It's fascinating seeing all the different covers, actually.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I bet.
Each country interprets it very differently.
And are they translated into each native language?
Yeah.
So it's in Russian and Chinese, yeah, and Italian. And
wow.
Are you at all involved in the translation process? Or is that completely out of your hands?
Varies. Some of the countries I have no involvement at all. Some of them, they send me lists of questions about the translation, which is really fascinating because it's just things that you wouldn't even consider or think about.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, I was going to say it's just come out in Denmark. They've done a very beautiful cover, really gorgeous. The translator had lots of questions to ask, but the one I remember is that It mentions Carmel in The Girl in the Red Coat, mentions a puzzle, and she likens something to a puzzle. And the translator was saying, well, what kind of puzzle? You know, is it a jigsaw puzzle? Is it a certain type of game? And we had this conversation going back and forth for ages before I realized that actually in Danish, the problem is that there's no general word for puzzle. Well, it's got to mean something really specific, like Jenga or, you know, a particular game. And that was just so interesting to me, kind of quirk of language that they just didn't have the word for it. So we came up with a compromise, and it was fine. I don't know. That's the sort of thing I find really fascinating when you're being translated.
You know, in the U.S., there's a lot of, well, a lot, but there are people who self-publish, Is that a common thing in the UK as well?
Yes, it is, absolutely, and sometimes really successfully as
mm-hmm.
well.
Yeah.
I think it's a really growing market to be self-published. From what I understand, it's easier if you're very, very strictly in one of the genres, like romance or thrillers or crime or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's true, but that's what I've heard. But yeah, it's absolutely huge, and I think publishing is an interesting thing. It's all mixing up at the moment.
Yeah.
It's all up in the air, you know, with digital and with self-publishing and with traditional publishing, and you know, and sometimes the thing they go side to side. Like sometimes people who self-publish will be picked up by traditional publishers very successfully, and vice versa. So I think it's interesting times in publishing. It's kind of, you know, anything can happen.
Was self-publishing something you ever considered?
Well, I never went down that route, but it's something I would, you know, if I it's certainly something I wouldn't rule out for the future, because I don't think we know quite what's going to happen, and I've seen people do really brilliantly self-publishing, so definitely never say never.
Right. You know, I've spoken to some authors that, you know, were with mainstream publishers, but then they want to write a book that doesn't quite fit with that audience, and so they may turn to self-publishing for that book only.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it. I mean, even if you were doing it under a different name or
right,
something
right.
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, you mentioned that that your books have been translated into Danish, and of course, I'm a big fan of the Scandinavian detective genre. Yeah. And, you know, the Joe Nesbø and Harvey Mankiw. I can't remember his first name. But anyway, and of course, Stieg Larsson. And your book has been compared to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Uh-huh.
How did that feel when you read that?
Well, I mean, quite extraordinary, really. But then so much, you know, this publishing journey is just extraordinary from beginning to end. So, things like that do feel incredible, because, I mean, I just write every day. I just start with a blank page and write and do the best I can. You know, you don't set out thinking that anything like that's going to happen.
And once it does, I think there, you know, maybe looking back in history, there's examples of people that the fame and the success kind of undermines their ability to write. But it sounds like you've really kept your feet on the ground.
I really have. And I really feel that every day, I mean, as a writer, every day, you're just facing a blank page, and that's the same for all of us as writers. You know, whatever happens going forward, it's a blank page every day.
Well, what is your writing process like? What does it look like when you sit down? Do you, are you one of these get things out as quickly as possible?
I try and write every day, 6 days a week. I have a day off on Sunday. And I like to work pretty early in the mornings. When I say early, it's probably about 8:30, 9 o'clock, that I get in front of the computer and start writing. I like to have a word count, because I just think that sets some kind of discipline for it. On a really good day, I will write 2,000 words. On an average day, I will write 1,500. On a not a great day, I'll write 1,000. So I feel a lot of it is about, for me, is about discipline, is that if you sit down and work, then something, you know, you might not write the, you might not be writing something amazing that's King Lear or whatever, but you're writing, and you then you can go back. You can go back and change it. You're not committed. I mean, I edit enormously.
Do you edit as you write, or do you do a first, an unedited first draft?
Both. It's just, I think Hemingway said that writing is editing. And I write, I edit every day. I edit the last 3-4 chapters that I've written every day. So they all get edited. Every chapter will be edited, goodness knows how many times. Then once the first draft is finished, I will, I don't know how many times I will edit before my agent sees it. Maybe 14, 15.
Wow.
Okay, tell
me. I will work a little bit with my agent on it, and then it will go to the publisher, and then the editor will come on board, and we'll start all over again. So I honestly, and for anybody that's writing, I just, you know, please don't think, you know, every writer edits like crazy, and it's, in some ways, it's all in the editing. And I just think it's so important, and it's actually the fun part of it as well.
I think so too.
I was wondering if you...
I don't know why, it's just, it's fun, because it's tweaking and changing and refining and, you know, all of those things.
Do you have the ending in mind when you start the story, or does it develop as you, I mean...
I seem to have come to a kind of system, actually, where... Well, system would be to give it too grand a word, I think. I write the beginning and maybe 2-3 chapters, and very quickly after that I will go on and write the last page. And that last page will stay the same, and certainly the last line will stay the same. As now that I'm writing my third book, very early on, I had the last line. I knew exactly where it was going to end. I won't necessarily know how the 2 points up.
How you're getting from one to the other.
Yeah, I'll have some idea, but not all the kind of quirks and ins and outs of it. That kind of comes with the writing. But I will definitely, and I always liken it to... being in a boat in dark waters, and there's a lighthouse in front of me, rowing towards the lighthouse, and I can see where I'm heading, even though I'm in dark waters, even though I'm not quite sure how I'm going to get there, maybe.
Kate, before we run out of time, could you read another short section from your book?
Yeah, sure. I think I'm going to read a little bit, again, of Ruby from near the beginning of the book. And, like I said, she hasn't had a great upbringing. And this, I like this passage. It's quite a short passage, but I like it because this is really her, the beginning of her fight back. The idea came beautifully quickly, as all good ideas do. By the stove was the matchbox, and the little pink heads inside began calling to me as if they had tiny squeaky voices. Meg's favourite shirt was tangled with other clothes in the yellow plastic wash basket. I stuffed it up my jumper and left with the matches in my pocket, just pausing to get paraffin from the shed. In the safety of the forest, the paraffin-soaked shirt lit quickly. Soon it was a burning man, a burning Meg, the arms lashing about on the bare earth as if in pain. It blackened and crumbled and fell away. I stood transfixed, the smoking match still in hand, until I noticed the holly bush to my side shaking. Who's there? A small figure in denim shorts wriggled out, yelping with pain from the prickles of the holly. It was Joe from three doors down, 8 years old. I was the eldest of the children in the street. In the mornings, a row of little eyes followed me as I went one way to big school and they went the other to their small one. Joe, like the others, looked like a forest child with scratched legs and slightly greasy hair. A holly bush isn't a good place to hide, I said. He stood there chewing, and the sweet smell of bazooka bubblegum wafted over. What are you doing? He asked finally. I'm burning my dad's shirt because I hate him, but you mustn't tell, promise. He blew a large pink bubble, and when it burst, peeled it from his face and poked it back into his mouth. I won't. My mum says it's criminal what he does to you. I shivered and pulled my sleeves further down. Go on, get off home, and don't forget to keep your mouth shut. As he ran, I stamped on the ashes, and a wave of fear passed through me that almost knocked me over. I fixed on the charred remains in front of me and breathed hard. This day will ever be known as the day of the burning shirt, I said to the trees. The plastic buttons were still there, but disfigured from the flame, and as I ground them into the earth with my foot, I noticed the metal collar tips had survived the fire. They were still hot to the touch and burned my fingers as I put them in my pocket. As I replaced the matches by the stove, my skin rippled all over with what I'd done. It was so simple. Only one match gone, and I'd witnessed the outline of Mick writhing on the ground. Despite the fear, it was beautiful.
And that was Kate Hamer reading from The Doll Funeral, which is available wherever books are sold. Online, your local bookstore. We always encourage people to go into their local bookstore if they're lucky enough to have one.
Yes.
And you can always order the book if it's not there. So we're out of time. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today again, Kate. It was such a joy.
Well, thank you. It's been really lovely. Yeah.
And, of course, we'll look forward to your third novel, which will be coming out in the UK when?
I think in 2019.
Okay, so probably later in 2019, towards the end of 2019 here in the US, I'd guess. So stay tuned now if you're listening to us on Friday for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. If you're listening to us on Monday morning, have a great week. And thank you for listening to Writer's Voices and see you next week. Oh, Mom, do you have a word of wisdom for us?
Oh, yeah,
I almost forgot.
Yeah, I do.
Almost forgot.
Okay. To hang on to the past is to die a little each day.
See you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.